Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life. Speakers whose personal journeys awaken and inspire our innate spirit of service. Thank you for coming together to plant seeds for a more compassionate society.
So good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. My name is Amit Dungrani, and I'm really excited to be your host for this week's Global Awaken Call. Today, we have a very special guest speaker. His name is Mickey Lemley. Not only is he a director and producer of incredibly powerful documentaries, film, and television series, he's a person that can make you think introspectively, laugh out loud, and tug at your heartstrings all at once. Plus, he's a fun person to share a meal with as well. As I mentioned earlier, the purpose of these calls are to share stories, and Mickey does just that. He tells moving stories about human transformation through his work. And it's only apropos that we have a master storyteller, Bhavi Mehta, as our moderator today to lead our conversation with Mickey. Today will undoubtedly be a very rewarding call.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Amit. Last night I was in preparation for this call doing some reading, and And when you consider the films that Mickey has made over four decades, you approach an understanding of who he is and what he stands for. On one level, he's a critically acclaimed, multi-award-winning filmmaker. He was named one of the 40 artists who shake the world. He's the founder of Lemley Pictures, whose mission is to tell moving stories about human transformation. And that mission has meant Mickey has spent his working life traveling in the company of good people, even great people, and the lens of his camera has really always been turned in the direction of the transcendent. He's made films about mortals who have seen the Earth from outer space and walked the surface of the moon. He's made a film about the man who went from being a Harvard professor named Richard Alpert to Ram Dass, the beloved spiritual teacher who defined a generation with his groundbreaking book, Be Here Now. He's documented through two extraordinary films separated by almost a quarter of a century, the life of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Their friendship spans decades. He's the son of Edna Lemley, a Renaissance woman who founded International Gratitude Day. And it is such an honor to have him here with us today. Thank you so much, Mickey, for being with us.
Thank you for that introduction. That's the nicest one I've ever heard.
Well, we're off to a good start. I want to jump right in because there is so much to talk about. And you have, you know, these many decades of storytelling behind you. I'd like to rewind a little bit and kind of look at the foundation of all of it. Is there a moment you can remember or a series of moments or events in your childhood or young adulthood when you knew that you were meant to be a storyteller, when you felt the pull of your calling?
You know, I never really thought of it, but I think when I was in about fifth grade, I wrote this epic story that I would go down and every day after lunch read to the third graders in my school. And it went on for weeks. And I never really thought of it as being a storyteller, but I was the only one in the school that did that. I guess I've always told stories. I've always loved stories. And more and more now, I think that it's really all just a story. Everything is just a story we tell ourselves. I think that everybody believes that the voice that they hear in their heads is the truth. And they hear it over and over. And I think I heard a statistic. I don't know how they proved this, but that like 90% of the thoughts that you have today, you had yesterday. So we just keep telling ourselves the same story over and over again. And I really wonder if there is an ultimate truth, or if all truth is subjective. And that really all of us are doing is just going around telling ourselves the same story, and it doesn't, and you can take anything, from religious, what the major religions tell us, you know, or you know, I'm an alcoholic, I do good work, however you self-define, it's really just a story.
That's we're starting out with the heavy truths here. In that vein, what was the story that led you to filmmaking?
Well, I started filmmaking when I was halfway through college. I was majoring in American civilization, doing a lot of history and literature and stuff. That's the summer between my sophomore and junior years. I just decided I really want to learn how to make movies. I just had this incredible urge. And all through high school, I had written, I had done theater, I had done a lot of photography, but I never took that seriously. I mean, what was serious was, you know, English and math and history and whatever, you know, the serious subjects were. But I always loved doing this other stuff. Anyway, so that summer, the production classes at NYU and Columbia were filled, but Columbia had a course in film writing. So I took the course, I wrote a couple of movies, and at the end I borrowed a friend of mine's camera and went out and shot this movie of old people in Central Park. And when I went back to school in the fall, this wonderful Irishman was setting up a film program. And there was a film appreciation class and then a film production class. But it was the production class was restricted to seniors and graduate students in the theater department. So this didn't stop me. I went to his office, knocked on the door, had my film under my arm. And I said, I understand you're setting up a production class and I'd like to be in it. To which he said, well, you understand it's restricted to seniors and graduate students in the theater department. I said, well, I'd heard that, but I've already made a movie. And he said, well, we must see it. So I took the film from under my arm and gave it to him. And these were the old days before cassettes, and he had to take a projector out of the closet, and we pulled down the blinds, and he threaded it up, and we watched my movie on the wall of his office. And at the end of it, he said, okay, you're in the course. And I said, is it because of the quality of the film that I just showed you? And he said, well, yeah, but more important, you have the one skill that's essential to any filmmaker, which is you can talk your way into places. And in fact, it really is as valuable a skill as any other, because very often you have to convince people to do things that they might not want to do, or to be in your movie, or people to work harder than they might settle at a certain point, and you think it could be better, so you have to convince them to keep working at it. And then also sometimes when people are pointing guns at you, to talk your way out of places. It's a useful skill.
It's a useful skill. So from there, where did you study it formally?
Well, no. This wonderful Irishman, David Hardy, who sadly died soon after we met, his idea, which was the only way to learn how to make movies is to make movies. You can't read about it. You can't be told about it. You just have to do it. And so, you know, the first few weeks he gave us a roll of film and said, make a movie. And then he had this golden tongue. And so he would fly business class wherever, even if it was just the shuttle between Boston and New York. And usually by the time the plane landed, he would have sold a movie to the person sitting next to him. So at that time, the sort of rule of thumb for, let's say, an industrial-type movie would be about $1,000 a minute. So, for instance, he was sitting next to the headmaster at a boarding school in New Hampshire, and he said, you know, don't you think a promo film about your school would be useful? And I said, yeah, it would, but it costs about $20,000. And he said, well, if you just give us the money for the stock and the film stock and processing, I can do it for $3,000. So we were the labor. And so by the time I graduated from college, I had stuff on NBC and CBS and PBS and these professional quality movies.
Fantastic.
For the Civil Rights Commission in Washington, the City of Philadelphia, you know, all sorts of of movies.
If you had to put into kind of like thinking back to that time, like was it articulate in your head, like what the draw of the medium was for you?
I think it's just magic, you know. It's just magic. And I was just fascinated by all the technical aspects of it, of just creating these perfect moments. And you know, so much of life is sloppy, and if I can make like a beautiful minute in a movie that's just perfect, I feel like I've made the world better. And then if you can put 90 of those together, you know, that's what I strive for, is that each moment is a perfect moment. And, you know, I go through life, and very often I wish I had a fast forward button when some people are talking to me. And, you know, and as an editor, it's like, yeah, you could leave that part of the story out, you know. And it's hard to do with another living, breathing human being. They get all sensitive when you try to do it. But, you know, in film, you can do that. You can look at something over and over and over again. And it allows you to find deeper truths also, taking time with the stuff that you've shot, for instance. I treat the editing process like a meditation. And so I empty and just watch the material as if it's for the first time. Even if I've seen it 1,000 times, I try to put myself in the place of the audience who's going to be seeing it for the first time. And you know, when I talk to young film students, I always tell them, whether they ask it or not, I tell them what I consider to be the most important thing I can tell them. And that is that they have to be willing to let go of their preconceived ideas. They don't have to do it. They just have to be willing to do it. Hmm. Because at every stage in the process of making a film, you're confronted by that. So when I start a film, you have to start with some idea. You can't just say, gee, I think I'll go make a film about life. I mean, where would you point the camera, right? It's just everywhere. So you have to narrow it down a little bit. And so you have an idea, and then what I do is I go out and I research it and spend, you know, as much time as I can and talk to as many different people, you know, the experts and the artists and the nuts, and, you know, just try to get a sense of the field that I'm entering into. And what I find is that I find the deeper levels to the story than my preconceived idea. And so I kind of structure it. I have this process where I put scenes down on 4x6 cards, and I have a very big foam core in my office, and I put up the cards, and I start to find the structure for how I'm going to tell the story. And so I have an idea of what the structure of the movie is going to be. And then when I go out to film, I have to be willing to let go of those ideas, because it's real life and it changes. And sometimes people who said one thing a month before when I pre-interviewed them, they say, no, I wouldn't say a thing like that, you know. So, and I have to ask questions that will lead them to give certain answers. But they start, you know, they might say something very different. And then instead of throwing it out as being an error in the system, you have to be willing to see what they're really telling you, or what the story has evolved into, what's really going on, as opposed to what you thought was going to go on. And so the editing process is allowing for deeper and deeper levels of the story to come forth and emerge from the material that I filmed. And I sometimes liken it to Inuit or Eskimo carver who will pick up a piece of bone and just start carving, and not with a preconceived idea of what it's going to be. And he or she might reveal a walrus or a polar bear, and they feel like that was already in the bone, and they're just revealing it. And so I feel that sometimes when I'm editing, is that I'm not imposing my will on it. I'm just trying to allow the truth to emerge. And so I believe, without sounding too pretentious, that you can get to deeper and deeper levels of truth about what's really going on. And I believe we all have like an honest witness in us that kind of vibrates when somebody is telling you the truth of their being. And that's the goal. And I'll just say, for those people out there that are listening and maybe not filmmakers, this idea of letting go of your preconceived idea and allowing whatever is to really to see what really is, it works in interpersonal relationships. To the extent that you have an idea of who your partner is supposed to be to make you happy, you're going to create violence in your relationship, because that person might not be that person. So the question is, are you going to try to force them to be somebody that they're not to make you happy, which I can tell you from experience of several marriages doesn't really work, or just allow that person to be exactly who they are and appreciate them for that.
That's a beautiful and rich kind of practice that goes, as you're saying, far beyond filmmaking. And I think about how we're, you know, just as we are all storytellers in our own fashion, we're all editing in our own ways. And, you know, we're a selfie-taking, Facebook posting. We're a very sharing culture of, you know, our stories. And yet the kind of editing that you're talking about is very different than editing for presentation or for effect. You know, editing for truth, editing for meaning, editing for, you know, something essential to emerge is such a gift. And one of the things that I think about with filmmaking, like, you know, a word that surfaces is just perspective. You know, it's such an important word in art. And I think about how the way we live our lives and the way we, you know, act in the world really is anchored in what perspective we're choosing, either consciously or unconsciously. And that brings me to one of your early films, The Other Side of the Moon, where you talk to people who've had the physical experience of an extraordinary perspective looking down at Earth from outer space. And could you talk a little bit about what led you to that that project, and maybe some of the things that the insights that came from it for you?
Well, it's poignant because just this past week, Edgar Mitchell died. He was on Apollo 14, and he was, in some ways, one of the inspirations for the movie. I had met him in 1972. When I was researching a film on psychic phenomenon, and my path led to him. He had just set up something called the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and it was then in Palo Alto, and I went and met him. And in 1972, you have to understand, hair was identity, and so I had really long hair and big sideburns, and I'm talking to this guy who looked like he had total military bearing. He, you know, was a military pilot and had been at MIT and was totally straight with short cropped hair. And this was at the height of the Vietnam War. So, this was relevant. And we were chatting and he said, he was talking about psychokinesis and precognition and ESP and clairvoyance. And I'm listening to the words and looking at the image and something didn't connect. And I said, "Excuse me, sir, what happened to you when you were up there?" And he said, he said, Mickey, it's impossible to come from around the backside of the moon and see the Earth floating out there in this sea of vast vacuum and not have it profoundly affect you. So that, you know, that just got planted. And then a few years years later, I was in a workshop with Joseph Campbell, a month-long workshop at Esalen, and he had just come from being on a panel with one of the astronauts from Apollo 9 named Rusty Schweikert, who had had this amazing experience because every single the time and space was so precious, and they had so many missions and things to accomplish that each mission had to accomplish a whole checklist of things in order for the next mission to do what it did until finally Apollo 11 landed on the moon. So Rusty was on Apollo 9, and his mission was at this point was to test the backpack equipment that the astronauts were going to use on the moon. And so he was outside the spacecraft. It was in Earth orbit. And Dave Scott, who was also on the mission, his job was to take pictures of Rusty doing the things he was doing. And the camera jammed, and the film got stuck. And Dave said, look, I can't fix it with my gloves on. I've got to, you know, go back inside the capsule. So Jim McDivitt, who was the commander, said, okay, Dave, come back in, fix the camera. Rusty, you just hang out. So here he is. Floating over the surface of the Earth at 17,000 miles an hour, just with nothing to do. And he knew that this was a really rare experience, that nobody had ever had this before. No human being had ever had this experience. And so I said, well, so what did you do? And he said, well, I decided to empty of my mind of any conscious thought and see what came in. So the first thought, he said, the first thought that came in is he's looking down at just how beautiful the Earth was as it was passing below. And he said, what are we doing down there? And then he said, I let that thought go. And the next thought that came in is, what are we doing up here? He said, and then I let that thought go. And the next thought that came in is, what is this thing called me? And then he felt his mind just explode into the universe. And the next thing he remembers was Dave Scott pulling on his uniform saying, Rusty, we have to go back in now. And he said it took all of his athletic and military and pilot training to go back in. He said he didn't want to. All he wanted to do was stay out there forever. And so then when they came back down, he did what any of the astronauts who had any kind of transformative experience, they repressed it. Because once they had been in space, all they wanted to do was go back into space. And so if they started talking about God and the intelligence in the universe and, you know, this overwhelming feeling of consciousness, they would have been probably sent to some rehabilitation farm in Connecticut where they send all old CIA agents or whatever, but they would not have gone back into space. And so he repressed it until all of a sudden one day when he was on this panel with Joe, he started talking about these experiences. And so I had heard those two. So my assumption going into the film was that everybody must have had a similar experience. I mean, they were shot faster than a rifle bullet, you know, up into space. They orbited the Earth a couple of times, used the gravitational force of the Earth to whip them like, you know, we used to play as kids when the last person in the line got whipped out toward the moon, again, faster than a rifle bullet, and then go 250,000 miles across space and orbit the moon, and then the lunar landing module would separate from the command module. It would go down, land on the moon. Two guys would spend a few days collecting rocks and stuff. And then they would get back in the capsule into the lunar landing module and hope to God that the small pyrotechnical device that was supposed to blast them off the surface of the moon would work, you know, because if it didn't, there was no getting them. They would just wait until their oxygen ran out. And meanwhile, this guy is in the command module just orbiting, waiting for them to blast off. then they would hook up in space, use the Earth, the gravitational force of the moon to whip them back toward Earth, and take a couple of 2-3 days to get back. Meanwhile, as Mitchell said, they had to do what they called barbecuing. They had, because on the sun side of the capsule is hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit, and on the shadow side it was minus hundreds of degrees Fahrenheit. So they would slowly rotate the capsule on their way home and their way to the moon. And so all their jobs were done. So Mitchell said he just sat by the window. Hmm. And at one point the Earth goes by, and then the moon goes by, and then the sun goes by. And he said it was hard not to feel like you were the center of the universe. All the machinery and all that stuff was built by the lowest bidder in a government contract. So if that doesn't give you a sense of God, you know. So my assumption was that everybody who went to the moon would have had a deeply transformative spiritual experience. And when I got, again, I had to be willing to let go of my preconceived idea, because when I started talking to these guys, half of them said, nah, it didn't affect me at all. He said, we trained for so long, we knew what to expect. We went up there, we did our jobs, and we came back. So then the question came up for me, why not? Why didn't they have some profound experience? And I was talking to Edgar Mitchell one night after we were filming. We were just relaxing. And I said, Ed, how is it that, you know, guys like you and Rusty and a few others had these deeply profound cosmic conscious experiences where you revisioned the entire universe? And half the guys said it didn't affect them at all. And he said, Mickey, it's like bouncing a ball off a wall. If you weren't open to the experience, you didn't have it.
Hmm.
And so, you know, I think that, you know, it's metaphoric for the potentiality for each of us. If a dozen people go and see the Grand Canyon, you know, some people have deeply moving, consciousness-altering experiences. And other people look and go, oh, yeah, it's nice. We're going to have lunch. You know,
yeah.
It's what you're open to. And again, if you're not open to the experience, if you don't think it's a possibility or a value in your life, you're not going to have it.
Again, it just kind of stops you in your tracks and things like, what am I being close to? What am I being open to? And some of it's at such unconscious levels. And I think about, you know, one of your other films, Fierce Grace, on Ram Dass, whose story... you know, he was obviously open in a very real way.
Yes, he was.
To the forces, and you know, from the outer appearance, it could have, like, his trajectory could have been different. He could have, you know, stayed a scientist all his life, and just a scientist or a researcher. And I think what's a similar thread in all your work, whether you're talking to the astronauts or to Ram Dass or to the Dalai Lama, is that there is this element of it seems like, you know, you're putting a little wedge in people's consciousness, and kind of there's an opening that your films create and the stories you create and the people who are in them. I mean, I think so much of their work is about that. And I want to talk about kind of, you know, the role of, how, in your work, like how you see the role of grace or faith or, but before that, I want to kind of cover the story of how you came to make the film Fierce Grace. And that first, because I believe you met Ram Dass first in 1970?
In the early 70s, yeah. I was on Martha's Vineyard, and a friend of mine said, hey, you got to come hear this guy give a talk in the local church. I said, well, who is it? And he said, his name's Ram Dass. I said, oh, is he Indian? He said, no, he's Jewish. And I said, right, I'm going to go to a church and listen to a white Jewish guy with an Indian name give a talk. I don't think so. And he said, no, you really have to come hear him. And I said, well, Okay, and I sat in the back row on the aisle so that after 15 minutes, I could sneak out and tell my friend, well, I tried.
Yeah.
And 4.5 hours later, I was still totally transfixed. I mean, my mind never wandered for 4.5 hours to the past or the future or other things I could be doing. I mean, this was one of the great storytellers I've ever experienced in my life. And he had the ability to go from the very human, his own human failure on the spiritual path, to these metaphysical concepts, which I'd read about in college but never quite got. And all of a sudden, when it was wrapped in his story, I got it, or started to get it, or felt like I was understanding it. And I decided that anytime he was giving a talk in a city that I was in, I'd go hear him. And then I did some workshops with him, and over the years we started to get to know each other. And at one point he was trying to put together a slide tape, and like half a dozen of his different friends of his said, "You got to talk to Mickey. You got to talk to Mickey." So he finally called me, and I looked at his slide tape, and it was quite nice. But I, you know, said structurally, what you need to do is take the beginning and put it at the end, and take the end and put it in the middle. Yeah, because really, film's all about structure.
Yeah,
I mean, it's like, if you walk into a room, if most of the listeners, I assume, walk into a room, they notice the surface. They notice the materials that the walls and the floors and the ceilings made out of, and the decorations around the room and so forth. And that's fine. But like my brother's an architect, and when he walks into a room, he's looking into the walls and seeing mm-hmm. how structurally the ceiling is being held up and where the pipes are to go to the second floor bathroom and you know, all that sort of thing. And it's mm-hmm. the same for film. I mean, when most people look at a movie, they're seeing the surface of the story. But for a filmmaker, you're also seeing the structure of the storytelling, because it's you have to give the audience information and then more information and then more information so that when a certain moment happens, they'll laugh or cry.
Right.
And you also have to hold their interest and attention. And that's all done in the structure of the storytelling. And that's what the editing process in a documentary is all about, is finding that structure that's going to hold the interest and attention of the audience and then reveal to them whatever the deeper truths are that you're trying to communicate about. In a narrative film, it's done in the script. So that the structure of the storytelling is in the script. And so
with Ram Dass's film, you were saying, put the beginning at the end.
So he was very taken aback by it, but then he tried it and saw that it actually worked, and then we became friends after that. And when I finished Compassion and Exile, the first movie I made about the Dalai Lama 25 years ago, right after I finished it, I was invited to show it at a big international conference in Prague, and he was one of the speakers, and he sat in the front row, watched the movie, and came up after and said, "I love your movie. I want you to bring it to my next retreat and show it and talk about it." And I said, "You know, I'd be happy to do that, but you're next." And he said, no, I'm not ready. I'm not ready." And then a few years after that, I had made a movie about this wonderful South African explorer, philosopher named Sir Lawrence Vanderpost. And it happened that we were at a conference together in Manaus, in the heart of the Amazon in Brazil. And Ram Dass sat in the front row. He saw the movie, and afterwards he came up to me and said, "Hey, I need a copy of the movie. I've got to show it to these people. I want you to show it at my next workshop." And I said, "Okay, Baba, but you're next." And he said, no, "I'm not ready. And then he wrote me a letter, and he said, "You know, someday somebody will make a movie about me, and it should be you, but I'm just not ready."
Mm-hmm.
And I had in my mind exactly how I wanted to structure the film and what stories of his I wanted to tell, but how I was going to hang it all together. And then he had this massive stroke, and he almost died. And for the first 2 months after the stroke, he was in a hospital with tubes going in and out. He couldn't swallow, and he couldn't speak. And his doctor said, you know, he's either going to be a vegetable like this or he's going to die. And just little by little, through incredible will, he, you know, got out of the hospital. He started speaking. He had speech therapy and, you know, walking therapy and aquatherapy and all these things. And just right after he got out of the hospital, I went to visit him in where he was living in Marin. And we just hung out for the afternoon and chatted. And at the end of the afternoon, I said, maybe it's time we did our movie. And he looked at me and said, okay. And so I didn't want to, you know, be accused of taking advantage of him. So when I got back to New York, I wrote him a letter and I said, I think this is what we agreed to. Do you still want to do this? And he said, yeah. So, but then I had to let go of this movie that I'd been carrying around in my head for 8 years, because he couldn't tell. It took him 15 minutes or 20 minutes to tell a story that he used to tell in 3 minutes or 2 minutes. And so that afternoon on his porch, he pointed to himself with his left hand, which still worked. His right side's totally paralyzed. And he said, you know, this isn't who I thought I was going to be, because my vision of myself old never had a stroke in it. He said, if I think about who I was supposed to be or who I used to be, it just brings up suffering. He said, but if I just rest in awareness, I'm in bliss. And so it kind of mirrored the artistic challenge that I had, which was to let go of this movie that I'd been carrying around in my head for 8 years and see what was right in front of me and make a whole different movie.
Again, it just, you know, there's so many echoing themes here, just that openness, that idea of emptying of preconceived notions and allowing what is to sort of be, to unfold and have that be the story is such a gift. And Fierce Grace is, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's a jewel of a film. And there are many, as a filmmaker, I imagine that it, you know, it came with its own set of new challenges with working with the conditions and the constraints of Ramdas's physical condition. And like you said, not, you know, and he's such an articulate man, but you don't get sound bites, and working with that new rhythm and making it as much a part of the texture and the gift of the film is something that Fierce Grace does. And Ramdas talks a lot about grace. And I was wondering how you relate to that word and what it means to you and, you know, in your own life and your work.
Well, he's an amazing human being. There's nobody like him. And the fact that he got to a place where he saw his stroke as grace, fierce grace, as he calls it, is quite amazing. My uncle had this same stroke. He was paralyzed on his right side, had speech aphasia, but he woke up in hell in hell every morning, because he thought, this is not who I was supposed to be. There's an error in the system. This is an error. And the average life expectancy of somebody with a stroke like that, I believe, is like 3 to 5 years. And Ramdas has had it now for almost 20 years. And he's thriving. I was just with him last week, and he lives in Maui now. My new film about the Dalai Lama was invited to the Maui Film Festival. And so I stayed with Ramdas, and he came to the screening. And he has a workshop that he does every December and has for years in Maui. And they opened up the workshop, and within two days, 300 places were taken or sold out. I mean, 300 people were there last year. And so he holds the stage. He can still, you know, touch people deeply, even though it's not the way he did it before the stroke. But, you know, he sees the stroke as grace, because it allowed him to see all kinds of, as he says at the end of the movie, he said, I was, you know, clumping along thinking that I knew what life was about. And then all of a sudden the stroke happened, and it's this whole new existence. And he's become, you know, I see Ram Dass's journey. He had different phases. He was a psychologist, had a doctorate from Stanford, got a job at Harvard teaching psychology. Then they moved Timothy Leary into the office next to his, and he started doing all the initial research into psychedelics. Then he became the first professor in the century at Harvard to get fired, and met his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, who transformed his life. He became Ram Dass, which means servant of God, and wrote the book Be Here Now, as you said in the introduction. And it's still in print. It's in its 44th printing or something. Mm. And he's touched millions and millions of people, opening up in them a sense of their own spirit. But it's not like a cult where he says, wear my picture and be like me and do the practices I do and dress like me. He just opens up people's inner life or spirit to themselves, and then it's up to them to find the form that's most comfortable. And so, you know, I mean, there are Hasidic Jews who feel like their spiritual journey was started by reading Be Here Now, and there's Buddhist monks in Thailand, and, mm-hmm. you know, Catholic monks who all feel like Be Here Now opened up their lives to their spirit, and then they found the form that was most comfortable.
And for you, what is that form?
Well, I am what Ram Dass calls a sloppy eclectic. You know, if the living spirit is vibrating, and then I'm all for it. And if it's dogmatic and rote and a belief system that's being propagated by people who don't experience it themselves, but are just reporting about what other people once did or didn't do, I have no tolerance for it.
So how did a sloppy eclectic come to make the best and probably most comprehensive films on the Dalai Lama that the world will ever have?
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, he's the real thing. He's the real deal. When I first met him, I was just struck by how funny he was. He was not at all what I expected. It was at a big conference in Davos in Switzerland, and at the end, this woman asked each of the speakers, you know, what do you think is going to happen in the world 50 years from now? And all of the speakers, you know, standing at a podium, addressing 800 people, answered her. They said, well, we'll probably have more of this, and we'll have less of that, and, you know. And they answered, and when after His Holiness's talk, she asked him the question, and he thought about it very deeply, and then looked at her and said, Madam, I don't have any idea. And he just cracked up. He said, I don't know what kind of tea I'll be having for dinner tonight. How am I supposed to know what's going to happen in the world 50 years from now? And I thought to myself, okay, so when was the last time I heard a political or religious leader publicly acknowledge that they didn't know something? And I couldn't think of a single example. And he does it all the time. You know, you ask him a question, he says, I don't know. And he always surprises me with how funny he is.
We actually have a clip from the last Dalai Lama that we wanted to play the audio for, that just kind of beautifully illustrates what you just said, and I think our listeners will benefit from it. Amit, is that something you're able to cue up now?
One of the benefits of having this long relationship with His Holiness is that I'm comfortable asking him questions that are quite sensitive, like questions about his own death.
At the end, I think last breathing, if my mind clear, and I'm quite sure I will remember while I'm dying, remember about altruism, entire sentient being. So that I'm quite sure. I can practice the moment of my last breathing. If some accident happens or aeroplane go down in the sea, then I don't know.
I love that. I love that. Can you share a little bit about that moment?
Well, bless his heart. I was told by my Tibetan friends that it's really rude to bring up the Dalai Lama's death to him personally. I've been told that by several of my Tibetan friends. But, it's part of what the movie's about is how the world's most conscious person is facing aging and death. He turns 81 in a few days. Mm-hmm. On the 6th of July, and I had to ask him about it. So I prefaced it by saying, "Your Holiness, my Tibetan friends tell me that it's really rude of me to bring up your own death to you personally. But since I'm an ignorant Westerner and you're the world's most compassionate person, I thought I would do it anyway." And he just laughed, and so that I asked that question that you heard in the clip that you played.
Yeah.
And that was his answer. And it was just, it was so unexpected, and just so funny that, how can you not love the guy?
What was the difference for you in making the two films?
Well, there's a 25-year gap, but I mean, I got to know him very well making the first movie, and I've had the honor of being the chairman of the board of a foundation that was founded under his auspices, called the Tibet Fund, and I serve as the chairman of the board and have for 20 years. So I pretty much see him every year in some form or other. And so I feel like I'm more comfortable in a way with him. He's more comfortable with me. Mm-hmm. I've certainly changed over 25 years, and my thinking and concerns have changed, as have his. And so it was a process of exploring, like, how so. And also, I feel now there's an urgency to what he communicates. He really wants to communicate about certain ideas and concepts and put them out in the world and have them have an effect. And so I think that's all through the movie.
Are there certain kind of moments that you can remember from filming either this, The Last Dalai Lama, or Compassion in Exile, that kind of electrified you, or just sort of like, this is why I'm doing this?
Well, there's a wonderful moment in the new movie called The Last Dalai Lama, with a question mark. I had asked him in 1991 when we filmed, I said, "Do you hate the Chinese?" And he said, "No." He said, "Sometimes I lose patience with them." But he said, "No hatred feelings." He said, "And in fact, I do this practice every day called exchange, or take and give." He said, "I take in my imagination, I take their ignorance and their anger and their violence into myself, and return to them love and compassion." So I got to 25 years later, ask him a follow-up question. So he's sitting there, and I said, "Your Holiness, 25 years ago I asked you about whether you hated the Chinese, and you said no, and then you explained this practice." I said, "So you've been doing this practice of exchange, take and give, for decades now." I said, "Has it done any good?" I said, "Who's it for?" And he just, without missing a beat, he said, "Oh, I do it for myself." He said, "It's not going to solve the problem." He said, "But it keeps my mind calm, and that can be very important." And so one of the major themes of the new movie, and we look at it from his work with cutting-edge neuroscientists and educators and others, psychologists, is this idea that it is possible that the Tibetans for a millennia have had the technology for overcoming negative afflictive emotions. And by that I mean anger, jealousy, greed, ignorance, and it's possible to overcome them in yourself and instead increase your capacity for happiness and compassion, and that's the way to do it, and that's ultimately the only way we're going to ever have peace in the world, if enough people do this. And so a lot of the movie is about that, about how the cutting edge scientists and neuroscientists are working with this material and the effects of it. So so that's part of what he was saying about hating the Chinese. Mm-hmm. It's like, but then he went on to say, he said even altruism. He said you do altruism for yourself. It's you do love and forgiveness for yourself. It's not for the other person. It's for you. So that your mind is calm, because you need a calm mind to make good choices. If you're being driven by greed and anger and hatred and fear, you're going to make bad choices.
Wow. We're going to segue into the Q&A session soon, but I'm tempted to ask one more question before that. I was just wondering, working to tell the story of the Dalai Lama, or whether it's Ram Dass or Sir Lawrence Vanderpost. I mean, these are incredible, figures. You show the Dalai Lama laughing. You bring humor. You bring a certain humanity into your portrayals of these people. But at the same time, I can imagine, just what you shared, the story of his practice of forgiveness, his practice of, embracing his own moment of death. Does it ever feel, as a filmmaker, like, how do you keep perspective, without feeling dwarfed by these figures, without, feeling like you don't want to put them on a pedestal, at the same time you want to reveal kind of the extraordinariness that they embody? And how do you find your footing within that dynamic?
Well, I go back to the first talk that I heard Ram Dass give in this church in Martha's Vineyard in the early 70s. And the subject of his talk was that we are both human and divine simultaneously, and that the art form is to hold both. That if you go too far into just being human, as the Tibetans tell us, if you take on an incarnation, you're going to suffer. You're going to get sick. People around you are going to die. You're going to hold on to your tech stocks too long. Just all of these things will make you suffer. But if you go too far into the being divine, you run the risk of forgetting your zip code, and that can become problematic. And so the art form is to hold the tension between the two, that we're both human and divine simultaneously. And the problem that I have with a lot of so-called spiritual teachers, and I put that in quotes, is that they promote their divinity and deny their humanity. And I was asked, after I did the first Dalai Lama movie, a lot of so-called spiritual people or their handlers called me and said, we'd like you to consider making a movie about our guru or our teacher or whatever. And I'd say, well, it's not a spigot that I can turn on or off. I have to meet them and see how I feel about them in my heart. And if I got the sense that they were doing what I just said, which is promoting their divinity and denying their humanity, I was out of there, because it's really dangerous. It's really dangerous to have a teacher that denies their humanity. And so I need to have both. in anybody that I want to spend time with or believe their teachings. Because it's too easy. If you take an abstract idea that so many spiritual teachers will spout, and you say to yourself, you know, it just sounds great, and your mind vibrates. You go, oh, God, that's fabulous. I want to write that down and think about it first thing every morning. And so you say, no, I'm going to get my friend who does calligraphy to do it really beautifully, mm-hmm. and I'm going to put it on my refrigerator so that I start every day thinking this really beautiful thought. And so you do that, and you put it on the refrigerator, and then the first morning you go, oh, God, that's how I want to structure my day and my life. And the next morning you think, where's the milk? I need it for my coffee. Because it doesn't have the kind of weight that means something to you. So when I'm interviewing these great beings with fabulous things to say, and they say something that's just amazing about all of humanity or something, I'm not fooled. And what I do is the follow-up question is, and when did that occur in your life? When mm-hmm. did that happen to you? When did you mm-hmm. realize that? Mm-hmm. And then I root it in their experience. Because the thing that we really all have in common is our common human experience. And so when somebody is telling you about their experience in an honest way, it resonates with your experience. And an abstract idea is very seductive, but it doesn't have the grounding that makes it useful for you in your own life.
That's powerful. I like that. I like that approach of waiting for that ring of truth in your own heart before you decide to move forward or not with a particular project or person.
Well, you know, you started this your description earlier by talking about myths, and I had the very good fortune of spending a lot of time with Joseph Campbell toward the end of his life, and he was the foremost authority on myths of anybody I've ever met or read. And he said that myths really come from the organs of the body. That you can't make up a myth because it wouldn't ring true. And the myths that last are the ones that come out of human experience, the human life cycle, and that come out of that. And that's why they last. That's why they resonate. That's why you can, you know, relate to them thousands of years later because they do touch this truth that has to do with all of our human journey.
That's I've never heard that myths originate in the organs. I like that. They're tied to our human brain, that they do come from the depths of our being. And that concept too of like the true myth is just so, it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around. And I think it's similar to, you know, the kind of work that you're trying to do in some sense with your filmmaking is tell true myths.
I'm going to move to one of our callers that we have in the queue. That's okay?
Sure.
While we get that going again, I have a question for you as well. Sure. In that, you know, I've just listening to you throughout the call, I mean, I kind of really do feel like you're truly a filmmaker because I've noticed that through a lot of the conversation, you've put the lens on the stories of others. And I was hoping we could also focus that back to you for a minute. And you've talked about how depending on what you remain open to is sort of how you will experience your life. And it's apparent in a lot of, in some of the work, whether it's on the Dalai Lama or Ram Dass, that there's this, you know, attraction to this idea of spirituality or consciousness, and it's something that you remain deeply open to. And I'm just sort of curious, you know, what helped you shape that lens for you personally, so much so that it's now translated over to some of your work? Were there a set of experiences when you were young, or was it this engaging 4.5-hour talk by Ram Dass, in the church? What was it for you?
Well, it's a good question. I go back to what Edgar Mitchell said, which was, if you're not open to it, you don't have it. It doesn't happen. So if I hadn't been open to it in some form or other, to what Ram Dass was saying, 40 years ago, I wouldn't have experienced it. I would have thought it was boring, and I would have left and gotten ice cream. So I look at all of my movies not as individual works, but as a body of work. And really, it's an external manifestation of my internal spiritual journey through my life. And I can see how my worldview shifted with spending time with each of these great beings. And they're not all, in certain interesting ways, they're not the same. I mean, for instance, the Dalai Lama says, if you ask him what's the meaning of life, he says happiness. He said the meaning of life is to be happy, but not happiness by getting more stuff or, acquiring things, but by serving others so that they can be happy. And Lawrence Vanderpost, who led commando units in World War II in Java, and was thrown in a Japanese prisoner of war camp and turned the whole thing into a university, said that happiness comes and goes, that really the purpose of life is meaning, that if your life has meaning, then you feel like you belong. And that's what's really essential, is the sense of belonging. And Ram Dass would say, the meaning of life, the purpose of life, is to get as close as possible to God, and I was with Joseph Campbell one day. We were at his men's club, the Century Club in New York, and we were going to have lunch. And he said, "Before we go to have lunch, would you like to have a drink?" And I said, "Sure." So we go up to the bar, and it's noon, and it's big overstuffed leather chairs, and the bartender saw Joe come in. Joe never even nodded to him, but he brings this glass, a double shot of Glenlivet single malt scotch, and Joe says to me, "Do you like single malt scotch?" And I said, "Well, yeah, it's actually my drink of choice." He said, "Would you like one neat or ruined?" And I said, "Neat." And so he motioned to the bartender, who brought me a double Glenlivet. And I hadn't eaten breakfast that day, and I had run, I jogged, and I do like single malt scotch, but I've never had it during the day, and especially at noon on an empty stomach. So I'm sitting there, in this incredible, beautiful single malt fog, talking. And Joe, when you talk to Joe, it was like the conversation was just so wide ranging. It just went everywhere, and it was just fascinating. And at one point, I remember him saying to me through this fog, "Well, you do know what the meaning of life is." And I said to myself, "Mickey, pay attention. One of the great minds on the planet is about to tell you what the meaning of life is, and you really need to remember." And he said, "The meaning of life is whatever you define it to be." And it reminded me of when I was going to get married to my future ex-wife, and we went to see this rabbi who was going to perform the ceremony. And he said, "All that getting married is standing up in front of your friends and family and saying, this is a special relationship. And by saying it, it becomes so." And he said, "One of the great inventions that the Jews had was the Sabbath, that by saying this day is special, it became so. Just by saying it, it became so." And that's what Joe was also saying to me about the meaning of each of our lives, is it's whatever we define it to be. If you define the meaning of your life to be about acquiring material stuff, then that's what it'll be. If it's about serving others in whatever form it is, that's what it'll be. If it's about creating something new that has never been seen before in order to help others to understand their own lives better, that's what it'll be. And if it's nothing if you never define it, and you just sort of then the winds of change and tides are going to just bump you down through your life, and it won't be defined.
So then, Swami Ecolectic, I have to ask, how have you defined it, and has it come so?
My own life?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a quote from a wonderful French filmmaker. He said, make visible that which without you might never be seen. And I think that, you know, for whatever the combination of my experiences and propensities and talents, I've tried to create entertaining work that is interesting to watch, you know, holds your interest and attention, and potentially can move people's hearts and minds to experience their own lives in a way that could be enriching for them. But at the core, it's just telling great stories.
And that you do well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Carol Ruth Silver, and I'm in San Francisco, California.
Hi, Carol.
Hi, and I have a question about the Ram Dass film, Fierce Grace. Have you had any success in using that as a therapy for people who have suffered strokes to encourage them to try and recover in the same way that Ram Dass did? That's my question.
Well, thank you for that. I have not personally done it. I know that various organizations and that deal with stroke have used the film in various ways. A lot of people have called me over the years and said, oh, this friend of mine just had a stroke. You know, how can I get them a copy? And I know that that's been widely done. With mm-hmm. people with stroke, but in a way, the stroke is metaphoric for the winds of change coming through your life, uninvited, unexpected. And so, I've had lots of calls. There's a part in the movie where this couple talk about the murder of their 13-year-old daughter, mm. and Ram Dass writes them this exquisite letter. And I've had hundreds, if not thousands, of requests for that letter. And, mm-hmm. I, you know, over the years, people have just, when they find out that I've made the movie, they said, oh, you know, my beautiful 18-year-old daughter died last winter in a car accident, and it was only watching your movie over and over every day that it got me through. And so, you know, as much as I feel their pain, I'm glad that I was able to do something that could help them with that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
We actually had someone that wrote in, Barbara from the UK, and she asks, how do you attract financing for your films?
The million-dollar question, as it were. you know, it just takes a lot of time, a lot more time than anybody ever wants. But I'm a firm believer that it's easier to raise money for a project that's moving than one that's a dead stop. And so I try to raise enough money to at least start shooting whatever it is, and then cut together a promo, a 5 or 10 minute promo, and use that to raise the rest of the money and raise it as I go. And, you know, there's some desperate months in there when it's like, I'm not sure how I'm going to pay people. And then, you know, you just keep, a lot of my work is fundraising. You know, half the time it's raising money and half the time it's making movies. So it's just the reality.
Mm. How is it that you come to choose the topics of your films, your documentaries, or even some of the projects that you take on in television?
Well, I have to feel a draw from my gut. I have to be curious about it. It's like, I want to know more about this. So when I heard the Dalai Lama say that he didn't hate the Chinese, I thought, I want to learn, how does he do that? How can he do that with the Chinese and I can't do it with my brother and sister? And so it comes from curiosity, and that's what drives me through each of the projects. It's like I want to learn more about it. I want to find out more about it. And there are filmmakers who know what they feel about a subject before they even start the movie. I'm not going to mention names, but some of them are very well-known documentarians who, you know, make a movie about gun control or health or, you know, something, the American health system. Mm-hmm. And you know how they feel about it. So it becomes a political statement of a point of view. And by being such, anybody in the movie is either supporting that point of view or refuting it, and then they're ridiculed. And so everybody in the movie is being exploited toward that end. But I don't see it that way. It's like I'm not making a movie about something I know. I'm making a movie about something I want to know about. And so the process of making the movie is also the process of discovery. And so it has a kind of vitality to it that I think if you know what you feel about a subject when you're going at the start, it won't have that dynamic vitality.
And as you've gone through these films, what have you discovered about yourself?
Well, I'm pretty funny. And I appreciate that. I can see my worldview change with each of the films that I've made. In very profound ways. And I'm just blessed to have had the experience of being with some of these great, great beings that, you know, have informed not only me, but millions of people around the world and opened up to them a sense of their own inner lives. And I think that they're all in some way what I call threshold beings, that they open up for people their own inner lives. Because, you know, I mean, one of the things that all the traditions tell us is that real happiness is inside of you. There's nothing outside of you that will make you happy. It's not a new car, a new boyfriend, a new girlfriend, a new house, you know, a new job, a new position. It's, you know, you think, yeah, the new job's great, but, if I had a promotion, I'd have more money and whatever. Or, you know, all this money's great, but if I had, you know, just another 100 million, I could get the bigger plane. There's nothing outside that's going to make you happy. And so, to anybody who can open up your inner life to you, and you can focus on that and not external things, I think those are the great teachers.
I want to jump in quickly here and just say, Mickey, that you know one of the most beautiful pieces of writing that I've seen from you is the eulogy that you wrote for your mother, who, from everything I've read about her, was just an incredible Renaissance woman. She danced with Martha Graham. She ran art shows in Paris. She was a poet. She was, interested in sailing and international politics, and she founded International Gratitude Day. Which is just, to me, that's like what a legacy to leave to the world. And at the same time, you know, you talk so beautifully in your piece about how it wasn't necessarily the easiest of relationships, especially in the early part of it, and that she was a force of nature and that came with its own, you know, weight. And yet, you know, the end of her life there was such a transformation and a sweetness in your relationship and the way you showed up for her in that phase, and you know the way you did that piece together, and I was wondering how, if you see any connections between how the work that you do is kind of priming you for your own life and the stories, like whether it's, you know, somewhere in that thread of your relationship with your mother or, you know, the story of your friendship with Ram Dass, with the Dalai Lama, with, you know, these incredible insights that have been gleaned along the way.
Well, I just feel incredibly lucky. You know, lucky me that I've gotten to spend time with some of these great, great beings. And, you know, it's not just, for instance, there were a finite number of times that I spent with the Dalai Lama to film this last movie. You know, his time is very precious. And but then it's not just being with him in person and asking him whatever I wanted about whatever I wanted, but it's going back and sitting at an editing machine for a year and going over the stuff he talks about over and over and over and meditating on it, and aging and death and service, mm-hmm. and, you know, compassion and anger, dealing with negative emotions. And these are the things that wake me up at 3 a.m. and that I worry about, I'm concerned about. And here I get to spend my job is meditating on these things. And I thought to myself, how many people can say that their work is the stuff that they're most deeply concerned about in their deepest self? How many people get to do that? And I get to. So I feel incredibly blessed and incredibly lucky that this is what I do.
Lucky us to get to hear about it.
Well, thank you for creating this forum and for doing what you do. I think it's lovely.
What, in terms of like that meaning of life question, you know, if you were talking to the generations that are up and coming, where would you, what direction would you point them in?
I would say, look into your hearts and what's most important. What's most important for you to do with this time you have here? What's going to ultimately be the most fulfilling for you as the person you are, given the personality you have, and make a contribution to make the world better?
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, interesting, you know, earlier in the call that you said 90% of our thoughts and ideas from yesterday sort of carry over today, and I just hope, I wanted you to know that the new 10% that you filled in today, I hope that remains as part of my continual 90% going forward.
let me know. Send an email.
We'll be playing reruns of this call every day.
Well, thank you very much, Nikki. Really, really appreciate you spending time with us today. And just, I mean, I can't wait to listen to this call over and over again, literally. There are just so many beautiful things and moments that you shared. And we're really appreciative of it. And is there anything that we can do to be of service to you as a community?
No, I mean, I just keep doing what you're doing. And, the new movie, The Last Dalai Lama? It just had its world premiere a week or so ago. It's going to be hopefully in places where you are. And so come see it when it's in a theater or there's a screening of it in your area, or if it's on some kind of television, or, you know, come watch it, because I think it's a pretty good movie.
Wonderful. Can't wait. We like to always close off our call as well with another minute of silence and gratitude. So just to kind of hold space for everything that we've heard and gratitude for you sharing your time. And then after that, we'll just take briefly everyone off of mute. And that way we can say sort of a group collective thank you to Mickey. So I'm just going to, I've taken everyone off of mute. And so if we could say a big giant thank you to Mickey, that'd be great. 1, 2, and 3.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Thank you all.
Namaste.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.